You're listening to the Webcomic Beacon at webcomicbeacon.com.
Welcome to another episode of the Webcomic Beacon here at webcomicbeacon.com, part of the Webcast Beacon Network at webcastbeacon.com, where you can find other shows such as Web Fiction World, the Webcomic Beacon Newscast, and did I say Web Fiction World? And First Issue, the comic book review video review show. This week on the Webcomic Beacon, I need to introduce myself first. I'm Fess of ArgerComic.com, and with me we have Mark Savory of AutumnLake.com.
Well, hello there.
And Kelly Turnbull of Manly Guys Doing Manly Things at thepunchlineismachismo.com.
Hello.
Or manlyguys.com, if you can remember that better. And this week, there's a few blogs that I follow on Tumblr, and some of them are pretty cool. And I've got one of them on my show. This is Please Welcome Sue of DC Women Kicking Ass.
Hey, everybody. How are you doing today?
They can't respond.
No, they're giving me the thumbs up. I can see it.
Yeah.
So you can find this blog at dcwomenkickingass.tumblr.com. Do you have an actual URL that redirects there, or is it just that?
Nope, just that.
All right. Well, there we go. And, oops, don't click that. Don't run that. All right, stop. There we go. And accidentally clicked your banner. And also, you apparently, and I didn't know this beforehand, you do a podcast on comic book resources.
I do. We do a podcast every other Monday, mostly. It's Kelly Thompson, who is a columnist on Comics Should Be Good. She has a column called She Has No Head. And we talk about comics. We review comics. We have guest stars on. We've had folks like Greg Rucka, J.H. Williams III, Cliff Chang, Kelly Sue DeConnick's been on a couple of times, and we just talk about comics and what we like and what's going on in the world of comics, and it's fun.
Alrighty, and let's see here. So we'll start off by talking about this blog you have called DC Women Kicking Ass. If you can, if you will, explain basically what it is.
Well, it's a blog that is focused on ostensibly on the women of DC Comics, and the guys. The original sort of reasoning behind it, I'll tell you a little bit of story. Was I had been in the comics community for a number of years. I hung around different places on the internet, the forums at CBR and Skins Daily, and I back about two, maybe 3 years ago, Greg Rucka left DC, and I was very upset because I felt that he had a very strong handle on how to write very strong female characters, and I was a little concerned about what would happen to some of those characters. So there were other creators there at that time, you know, who were writing good, you know, good strong female characters. So I decided to try and start a blog. Which would showcase these characters. And I didn't want to do a blog that had a lot of theory and a thought of writing. I wanted to do something that was kind of visual, but, you know, that I could put up some opinion pieces as well. So I chose Tumblr, which was an emerging platform at that time, and I launched it. Originally, it was called And Then She Kicked Their Ass. But it didn't quite work in the Tumblr. Like, the URL didn't fit. It was like it went on forever. So I actually called it that, but the URL became DC Women Kicking Ass. And then I kind of had people constantly referring to it as DC Women Kicking Ass and not the title that I wanted, which was And Then She Kicked Their Ass. So I sort of like gave that up. and so it's very clear, you know, it focuses on the women of DC Comics who kick ass. I expand a little bit out there, you know, sometimes it's Marvel. Sometimes it's other publishers. I've been covering a lot of comics from Image and Dark Horse. I cover Ani, because obviously Greg Rucka writes for them as well. And it really is, you know, just talking about how women are portrayed in comics, giving recommendations on good comics, talking with some of the issues that go on within, you know, the comics community. I touch upon some of the movies. I mean, obviously, this has been a really great 2 years if you like women in DC Comics, because you've had had the Dark Knight Rises with Catwoman. Lois Lane will be out in June with the Man of Steel. And that's it. And I put up pictures sometimes, and sometimes I put up commentary, and sometimes I put up reviews and all kinds of stuff.
And I wanted to jump back a little bit. Were you saying that this was basically sparked by basically what was becoming and soon to be the New 52 from DC Comics?
No, actually it was before the New 52. It was when Greg Rucka left DC Comics, which I guess was about, I want to say March of 2010. So that was about a year before the New 52.
Well, they had to do some planning for a while. I mean, I think they did some planning for a while before they started.
Yeah, but not that. The New 52 sort of started germinating in the fall of the year before it launched, according to the folks that I talked to. When Greg Rucka left, he left for a variety of reasons. I mean, we had an interview with him on our podcast. Mm-hmm. He was pretty clear about why he left. He wasn't happy there anymore, and he didn't feel that he was getting the things he was promised. The thing that was concerning to me was that he was leaving just at the time that Batwoman was supposed to be moving from Detective Comics off into her own title. And there was some confusion about what was going to happen to that character. And ultimately, they ended up moving forward with the book. And they have, it's co-written by, the artist who was on the book with, originally with Greg Rucka, who's J.H. Williams III. And, but it took a little bit of time for it to get, launched, because it was supposed to launch actually a year after that. And then they held it and they launched it with the New 52. Mm-hmm. So my blog and the New 52, certainly have had a lot of overlap, but my blog was started well before that.
And you do talk about, a lot of, characters, not necessarily of current events, because you do bring up stories and character stories from before the New 52, as well as characters that I don't think have actually yet appeared in the New 52 continuity just yet.
Right. Well, you know, DC doesn't just sell floppies for the New 52. They have a huge backlog that they sell through digital singles as well as graphic novels. So, you know, when you're a DC fan, you know, if you're looking for new content, you can go and buy the New 52, but you can also go and buy trades of past issues, or you can go buy arcs, you know, that they have their digital comics. It's mm-hmm. much easier to pick up that stuff. So there are a lot of fans of characters that are not currently in comics right now. People like to read about those. I mean, it's a wide swath. I mean, there are people who are still talking about versions of Wonder Woman that appeared years ago, and some mm-hmm. people like those version of women. There's characters that were not included in the original launch of the New 52. There are characters who have been killed off in the New 52, and there's a huge fan base for those folks. And you know, a lot of people come here because occasionally I'll write about them. I don't write about all new characters. I'll write about characters that have books coming up. You know, characters like Amethyst, who just got relaunched mm-hmm. into the New 52. I did an interview with the writer there, Christine Marks. I write about books like Katana, which is going to be starting in 2013. So she's a character who's been around in DC Comics for many, many years, and she's finally getting her own title. Mm-hmm. But then there are characters that have a fan base, like Stephanie Brown, who was originally introduced as a supporting character in the Robin books, which were written by Chuck Dixon, and then moved on to become a Robin to Batman for a little bit of time. Had her own persona as Spoiler, and then became Batgirl for 2 years within the DCU. So, you know, people do like that. And those books, you know, still sell. I mean, they're still a big fan base for them.
Yeah, I went to my local comic book store and specifically looked for the first appearance of Spoiler. That was pretty cool. And then she became Robin for like three books, and I found, I think, all three of them, and I read that, and that was really great, except Batman's kind of a dick.
Yeah, he was.
But, yeah, talk about a character of, like, somewhat controversy. She was a character that was killed off, and then is like, oh no, she's not really dead. And then they launched New 52.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with Stephanie Brown, which I think a lot of people relate to, is that she was used as a plot point for a lot of times. You know, when she was originally created, she was used as a supporting character for Tim Drake in the Robin book. And then she was kind of made a poster child because, you know, she was a teenage unwed pregnancy. And then, you know, the reason why she was made Robin was specifically so that they could kill her off in War Games. They basically had said that they were going to kill her, and she was killed kind of brutally. I mean, she was like sort of she was put on a large drill bit. And so the idea was, let's make her Robin. Let's make, you know, give her that, and then we're going to kill her off. And so they killed the
kill
character.
Kill another Robin.
They killed another Robin.
One.
Another Robin, right.
Batman
exactly.
has worse luck with Robins than Picard has with Enterprises.
He's only had five Robins, and right now...
Nobody liked Todd.
They're all alive. So they all come back. But the thing with Stephanie Brown was, when she died... the other Robin that had died, which was Jason Todd, had a memorial case in the Batcave. And there was, you know, several people online, quite a bit online, who said, you know, well, Stephanie Brown was Robin. She should have a memorial case. And DC said, no, we're not going to give her one. We absolutely refuse. And it started a organization called WorldGirlWonder.org, who was, you know, sort of bringing up the issues of the way female character versus male characters were treated. And people would go to conventions and they would say, oh, you know, you're going to give Stephanie Brown a memorial case. And the editor in chief, Dan Neo, would constantly say, no, I'm not going to do that for her. I'm not going to give her a case. And finally, they ended up bringing back the character, and she came back from the dead. It turned out she wasn't really dead. Done. And just like the other Robin, Jason Todd. And then when DC had decided to launch a new Batgirl title, they had originally thought about making Barbara Gordon, who was then the character of Oracle, who she had been Batgirl and she had been shot. And then she had developed a new persona called Oracle, which was sort of the information super jock to DC. Mm-hmm. And they were going to make her Batgirl again. And it was always a controversial issue because she was one of the few characters and one of the only characters in DC that was physically challenged. And DC came this close to making her Batgirl again, and they kind of backed away and said, no, we're not going to do it. And so they were stuck, and they kind of needed to make somebody Batgirl. So they chose Stephanie Brown, and they made her Batgirl for 2 years. And it was a very fun collection. It was the tone of the book was a little bit more fun than you were seeing in a lot of DC comics. It was very popular, very well reviewed. It was a New York Times bestseller. It was, you know, named one of the best of the year by New York Times. And then when the New 52 came along, DC decided, no, we're going to go back to the old school Batgirl. We're going to go back to Barbara Gordon. So they, part of the New 52, there was this time wrinkle that happened, and
thanks to Pandora.
It was Barry Allen was trying to have his mother stay alive. And so Barbara Gordon became Batgirl again, which was fine. Not my choice. Wasn't something that I liked the character of Oracle a lot. Doesn't something that I really liked. They DH'd the character. The challenge I think people felt is that as part of that, the character of Stephanie Brown and her predecessor, who had been the second Batgirl, Cassandra Cain, Bruce Wayne's adopted daughter, were removed from the books. And so you now have this new Bat sort of universe where you didn't have two of the female characters that had been in the Bat universe for the past 20 years. But yet you had Tim Drake, and you had Damian Wayne, and you had Jason Todd. So people had different opinions on that. I have my opinions on that. The controversy comes from the fact that people have said, you know, can you bring back Stephanie Brown? And they have, you know, constantly say, no, we're not bringing back Stephanie Brown. And then when some writers try to sneak Stephanie Brown into the books, DC has shut it down and said, no, that's not happening. So it's a little confusing about why it's happening. But she does have a very vocal fan base. And, you know, I think that eventually everybody will show up again. I don't think anybody, you know, thought that you would see some of the characters who come back from the past. So, you know, I guess, you know, time heals all wounds. I was just did a post the other day about Christmas stories and was talking about how when they had the original Crisis back in 1986, they killed off Supergirl. And for years, they tried to keep her out of comics. And, of course, eventually she came back as well. So
they always seem to come back, don't they?
Yeah, it's soap opera. I mean, you know, the differences between DC Comics and or any comic, any of superhero comics and soap operas is negligible, to be perfectly honest. I did an essay for a book called Chicks Dig Comics last year where I talked about how when I was a kid, you know, I had to really – things that I grew up with that I really loved in pop culture. And the first one was Batman. I loved Batman. And hence that was where I developed a great love for Batgirl, who's my sort of favorite superhero. And then, soap operas. And if you think about it, you know, you have serialized stories, you have, villains that are horrible and you have, you know, these dashing heroes and heroines and you have people coming back from the dead. You have children growing overnight. You know, like Damian Wayne, where did he come from?
That was actually, apparently Damian Wayne was from a terrible comic that DC did back in like 1987 that they wanted everybody to like forget about where, right. Yeah, it was like Batman and Talia al Ghul had some like torrid love affair and he knocked her up and they left the baby in like a bassinet on some other billionaire's, and when they were like, you know, like, hey, cause I don't really read much DC outside of like Secret Six and kind of like the one character or whatever that I'm interested at the time. And so like that was like one of the things that I just randomly knew about. And when they were like, oh, we're bringing back Damian Wayne and we're going to make him like Robin or whatever, I was like, what are you talking about?
I remember part of when we started doing First Issue, we went through all of the new number ones of the New 52 because I had never read comic books before. It was just newspaper comics and web comics. So all this continuity, aside from whatever was in like a cartoon show or the movies, I never knew about. And so I was like looking, there's like, what, six Batman books, and one of them is Batman and Robin. And I was like, okay. I know there's some sort of reboot here. I didn't know who this character was, except maybe it might have been like, Dick or something. I don't know, like years ago. And, I'm like, boy, Batman's really laying on like the father son thing here. Well, he's kind of creepy. What the hell is this? I had no idea Damian was actually his real son, because I never known of the character. I was like, wow, that's a little creepy, Bruce.
Yeah, well, you know, the you're absolutely right. They had done that. They had that Talia al Ghul and Batman hooking up in I think it was called The Son of the Demon or The Demon. And for years, you know, nobody ever read it or anything. But when Grant Morrison took over Batman, and Grant Morrison is somebody who, you know, he basically, there's not any continuity in Batman that he will not put into a story. I mean, if something has happened in, you know, a story in 1956, he believes that everything that ever happened in the history of Batman is real, you know, in terms of the Bat history. So he picked that up and he created the character of Damian Wayne. And it was, I don't know if you read the Batman and Robins, but it was kind of funny because Damian was such a spoiled brat. And, you know, he comes into, you know, Wayne Manor. And, you know, Bruce is Mr. Cool, right? Nothing. Joker could be staring at him with a gun. But then, you know, he walks into like the, you know, Damian's room where he's got like, you know, the earphones and he's got the video games and there's food all over the place. And he's just like, oh, and he walks out, you know, because Alfred has to take care of this. So it's the one thing that Batman hasn't had, which is a really rotten kid. And so when they brought Damian on, that was part of his, you know, charm, so to speak, was is that he was just so insolent and so full of himself. And he was supposed to be killed. I mean, Grant Morrison was going to have him die at the end of his first arc, but everybody sort of like liked him. But then, unfortunately, DC kind of made him into the Scrappy-Doo of the Bat universe. I don't know if you ever remember the Scooby-Doo cartoons, but Scooby-Doo was a really good cartoon, but then they had his nephew Scrappy-Doo show up, and then he was like, Scrappy-Doo! It was Scrappy-Doo. It was like it's like either he's either it's Scrappy-Doo. Scrappy-Doo was the Oliver.
Of the he was. Oh, it's awful.
And Damian is I believe he was very close to coming because he was showing up in everybody's comics. Everybody, and he still does. It's like he's sort of like the easy way for somebody to write a comic. Oh, what do you want to do this month? I don't know. Let's have Damian show up and be a little jerk. Oh, okay, that sounds cool.
Oh, he showed up in his first name kind of gives it away, doesn't it?
Exactly. You know, so he showed up in Teen Titans. He was showing up in Batgirl, showing up in World Finest. He was showing up in all the Bat books. He
was showing up. Like another name that people could use when they want to make like a demon joke. And it's like, it's always Damian.
It's always Damian. So, and now he's still shows up in a lot. He was on the cover of World's Finest, a couple of beating somebody up. So, but he's actually probably the most successful new character that DC has created over the last couple of decades, because everybody sort of has an opinion on him, which is a good thing. And, you know, writers like to use him because if you put him on the cover, people are like, oh, it's Damian. But he has people who really hate him too. I feel like he can be a fun character if he's written, depending on who he's written and written.
I think that's, you know, like, I think we were talking once about like, just totally broken characters that are like unsavable. And it's like, I don't know, like if you put them in the hands of the right writer, like if they put them in the right situation, like any character is salvageable.
Oh, I agree with what you mentioned. You read Secret Six, which was one of my favorite series that DC did. I thought it was one of the best series that DC had before the New 52. And that was Gail Simone. I mean, Gail Simone took all these like grade ZB characters that really hadn't been seen for a lot of time, like Deadshot, like Catman, and Bane, who, you know, today, of course, you know, Bane's a huge, huge star. He walked down a toilet. Bane, but that time Bane had been out of comics for a while.
Yeah, well, and that was why I was reading it, was like for Bane.
You love it. You're a Bane fan. Yeah.
I like the Freedom Fighters. They had their own book for a while. I don't know if they still do.
Oh, they actually might be coming back from what I understand, because slowly but surely you've been so you're talking about the Uncle Sam and the
Sam and the Freedom Fighters.
Yeah, I think you'll see them coming up pretty soon. But the secrets, you know, that I absolutely agree with you. I think there are no bad characters. There are only good writers, that bad characters who or that haven't met the right writer yet. And, you know, there have been some really characters who popped around in comics for many, many years, and then suddenly they'll get this writer and you know, they'll become a really great character again. I think one of the best characters that exemplifies that in DC is Green Arrow. I mean, Green Arrow, when he's written really, really well, you know, like when he was by, you know, Denny O'Neill, and when Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams did the Green Arrow and Green Lantern, Hard Traveling Heroes. And then when the Kevin Smith, I'm not a big Kevin Smith fan, but you know, his Green Arrow wasn't too bad. He can become a really great, interesting character. But when he's in the hands of a writer who's not so great, he becomes not a great character. And I'm really excited because they have a really great writer coming on board with him, which is Jeff Lemire, who had been doing Animal Man, who did the Animal Man reboot, and also has been writing Justice League Dark. And now he's going to be taking over Green Arrow. And I'm very, very excited for that, because I think he'll turn into a really interesting character again. Superman also has a problem with that. When Superman is written by a bad writer, he becomes a really annoying character. But when he's written by a really great writer, he can become, you know, a fascinating character. And I'm looking to that as well, because Scott Snyder, who has been writing, he's been the lead Batman character now for a couple of years. He's going to be taking over Superman, and the character really needs it. He's had some not great writers writing him over the past couple of years. There's been some good writers. I mean, Grant Morrison wrote Action, but, you know, oh, some of them have been like, oh, what are you doing?
Okay. All right. We got to take our first break. And hopefully when we come back, we'll talk about DC women kicking ass for a while.
Great.
Like animation? Come listen to Animation Aficionados.
And if you disagree with us, you could be a guest on a future show.
Available on iTunes, the Zune Market, and animationaficionados.com.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network. Follow us on Twitter at WebcomicBeacon. Email us at WebcomicBeacon@gmail.com. Or leave us a voicemail at 1-320-310-0922. Love the show? Please grab the iTunes or RSS feed. We are also on Stitcher.com with Stitcher Smart Radio, an on-demand service where you can stitch podcast and radio show feeds together for your own personal streaming service. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity in the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic books, news, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
It's fairly apparent that you're also on a podcast. Because you talk a lot. You feel in dead air time very well. And you cover a lot of points before somebody can ask a question. And then you answer the question that has but not been asked. That's a compliment.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I mean, we're Kelly and I actually we have a fun time doing our podcast because we never know what we're going to talk about. Sometimes we do. Sometimes we'll send little notes and go, okay, so we're going to review this, review that. We're going to do an interview, which we somewhat prepare. We do have some questions, but then we'll have these moments where we'll start discussing something and it will just turn into a free for all. We've had these huge fights about characters and things like that, but you know, I do enjoy. I do enjoy doing it.
All right. Let's talk about what should we talk about? When I first came into comic books, it was, you know, to DC. So I had a few hopes for a lot of the comics, since I read a lot of web comics that were showcasing strong female women as leads, a lot of web comics that were written by female creators. And so when I get into the world of mainstream comics, I guess I had high expectations for a lot of things. So I really clamped on to a Wonder Woman, for one, who was a badass female. And, you know, Batgirl, Batwoman, I was trying to get into. I really wanted to like Catwoman. I really, really wanted to, but she was one that was just so overtly sexual, like sexualized to a point of cartoonish standards almost. But, where was I going with? Oh, yes. And I also follow a blog called Escher Girls. You probably know about that one.
Yep. I love Escher Girls. They're great.
I should get them on the show sometime. But, so it's like, all right, there's some really good stuff here. And then it's like, when I start seeing the boobs and butt pose, it's like, what? I thought was like a thing of the past. What's going on? Are they serious?
I almost feel like the boobs and butt pose is like just the product of like so many comic artists kind of like learning to draw from looking at other comics. And it's like there are some where it's like it doesn't even seem like they're trying to be sexy. It just seems like they think that that's how women stand. Like it's like that's what they've learned to draw. They don't know any other way.
More like they're looking at porno mags.
not even them.
That's like the Greg Land kind of there are so many things where it'll be like a totally casual, like, you know, weird contorted, like, you know, it's like a pose that is possible to do, but not one that anyone would actually stand in. And it's just like, I think that you honestly, like, you weren't trying to make that overly sexy. You just don't know, like, any other way. Like,
I just imagine that all these women, the superheroes, they're all lounging around and they all talk breathlessly. Wow, Batman, what should we do with the villain? You know, it just seems
I hate to tell you that, but I'm not going to be surprised if there's more than one writer who writes their comics that way. So who acts it out? But yeah, now the broke back is the position that you're talking about. The broke back is the position where a woman's boobs and butt can both be seen at the same time, and it's a contortionate act. And there are many, many artists within both DC and Marvel who have a level of expertise at drawing the broke back, and the Asher Girl site is a site that sort of breaks down the anatomy of why this doesn't work. And what I like about them is then they sort of show how it could be corrected.
Yeah, some people do redraws. It's really cool.
Do redraws, and I think that's part of it. Is that what I've never understood. The heightened sexuality in comics. I really don't get it because, as I've said many times, you know, there's free porn on the internet. You know, I mean, if you really want to see those kind of poses and you really want to see that kind of stuff, why would you pay $2.99 for a superhero comic to get it? You know, I can send you to some website
right.
where you get it for free.
And that's just, yeah, that reminds me of Voodoo. I really wanted to like Voodoo, like, a lot. I mean,
I did too.
I mean, it is, you know, she is a fairly sexy woman when she wasn't in the strip club, she had freaking jeans and t-shirt. And that was, for some reason, incredibly hot. I mean, it was form fitting. And I mean, there was no low cleavage or anything. And she was, you know, fairly confident in herself, sort of like thing. But then, like, the first issue kind of like ruined us, like, what the fuck is going on? What the hell was that all about? Blah, blah, blah. You know, and then, of course, I read ahead and got the trade. And apparently there were some editorial changes that I don't know. It's like my first experience with dealing with, oh, well, that wasn't being received right. How can we save face a little bit?
Yeah, no, I mean, I was also looking forward to that book. You know, the Voodoo was only the second title in the history of DC Comics that was headed by a woman of color, the first being Batgirl with Cassandra Cain. I was looking forward to the book. I think Sammy Basri, who was the artist on the book, who was the second artist on Power Girl, is terrific.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I like his art a lot. But I think that they opened the book with some of the most overtly sexual pages I had seen in either DC or Marvel comic in quite a while, where she was on her knees in a strip club.
Right.
And it turned off a lot of people, and it turned off me. I mean, I was like, I don't get it. And then the second issue, there was a little bit more, and then I kind of lost interest in it. And then you're right, they got rid of the writer on the book, Ron Mars, who was kind of Witchblade was a book that he had written for a very long time at Top Cow, and then they brought in a new writer, and I just don't think the book ever recovered. You know, the challenge with Voodoo is just that, first of all, you're talking about a character that people weren't that familiar with. I mean, if you were a fan of Wildstrom, then you would have known the character. But, you know, I think first issues were really important, and I think that if you walk into a first issue and you're seeing, you know, a woman on her hands and knees in a strip joint, and she's supposed to be the heroine of the story, you know, I think more than a few people, men and women, are going to say, maybe this isn't for me. So I'm sad that they decided to do it that way, because there were some elements in the book that I think could have worked very nicely.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think the whole angle could have worked very well, because even when they went backstage and we got some humanization of, I mean, all the women back there just sort of like talking about how actual strippers talk backstage. Not that I've been back there, but I know that it's like a lot of that sort of just regular. No, this is just the job and that's just what you do sort of thing. It could have been done differently and much better, certainly, but yeah.
Well, like I said, you know, I don't understand sometimes why they do focus so much on the sexualization of characters, and they do. I mean, I know this for a fact. It is an issue that gets discussed in the editorial offices at comics. I mean, there have been artists who have been not gotten gigs on comics because editorials have said they don't think they draw women sexy enough. They're, you know, that they draw, have artists brought on who are known to draw a more sexualized book than something else. And some of those are some of the Brazilian artists, like Ed Benes is an example of that. I just don't get it because I'm not sure it works for them. I think I don't hear people going, wow, I'm going to go spend $2.99 on a book because Ed Benes is drawing it. Nobody's doing that. People might say, well, I'm going to go buy the book because Gail Simone is writing it, and she and Ed Benes tend to work well together. And it's not just women who are saying this. I had so many guys who are on my side. It's like, I just want a good story. Can I just get a good story with a good artist who can communicate, you know, emotion and interesting layouts, and please don't give me this Brokeback. So it's a dichotomy between, you know, what people want and what editorial thinks they want. And none of these books end up being bestsellers. I mean, if you look at what the best-selling books are, best-selling book is Batman. And to my knowledge, Batman has not appeared in a scantily clad costume or with both his butt and his boobs appearing and not any issue. So
a friend of mine, I think he was at Savannah College of Art Design or something. Like he, you know, went to school for drawing comics and that. And he was saying that there was some like kind of history of comics class that they were, it might not have been that. I don't want to be like setting people's hopes up for like what the classes are, one or the other, but it was, you know, some course in like the history of comics, and they were saying that when that sort of 80s style where everything was like, you know, kind of the 80s into the 90s where it was all like super extreme and it was like almost like pseudo heavy metal, and it was
extreme.
Like all the women looked like, you know, like those fancy powder pigeons with like the big chests and like no waists and stuff, and like, you know, all the sort of like, you know, I think Rob Liefeld's a nice guy, but you know, like the Liefeld kind of style.
Yeah.
That was right when people were realizing that like the golden age, like classic comics from, you know, like the 40s and all the ones that kind of got lost when
they're dead.
You know, the paper shortages during the wars and stuff. And yeah, that like those were starting to go for like a lot of money on, you know, like auction places, and people were like really, right. Like that was like the collector market started. And so, you know, all these like extreme comics started coming out, and people were like, let's buy all of them because yep. they'll be collectibles someday.
Right.
And so when Marvel and DC were looking at the numbers, they're like, wow, people love this stuff. And so they just started making like everything was like super extreme and super sexy and all that. And
oh, and they started doing like die cut covers, gloss cover. I have like 10. No, wait. Yeah, I have like 10 polybagged issues of the collector's issue of X-Force with the free trading card in it, as well as like 5 regular ones that I got all for 25 cents each, because I'm planning to do a big joke with them at a future first issue review.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll go long box digging. I have a couple of comic book stores that I go to all around the area. I live up in Boston, so I'm very lucky. And, you know, it doesn't take me more than 5 minutes to get into a room where there's long boxes to find polybag copies of The Death of Superman. You know, I mean, for a quarter. You know, and it's like there were people who really bought those. And I think you Kelly, you did an excellent encapsulation. You know, people began buying more and more of those, not because they wanted to read it, because they thought that in a couple of years it was going to be worth a lot of money. And they are not. You know, there's not, I don't think there's any, I mean,
they're mass produced, you know, they're not limited.
They were produced incredible amounts, and people were buying. I mean, you know, there's a really good book out called The History of Marvel. It's by Sean Howe. The Real History of Marvel. It just came out this fall, and it covers the whole history of Marvel from, you know, the very early years up, you know, to the creation of Fantastic Four and the Kirby and Stan Lee years. But it talks about that period of time, and you know, they're talking about the distribution channel there and how, you know, people would be waiting outside comic shops for the trucks to come with these polybag specials, and they would just buy like, give me all of them, I want them all. And how the comic companies themselves began to realize, oh crap, this is an artificial economy, that these really aren't selling millions of copies. It's an artificial economy. And so the comics came back down again. And, you know, and the numbers really haven't really changed since then. I mean, you know, most comics, you know, sell a really good selling comic sells about 100,000. And most comics are, you know, mid-tier sell around between 36 and, you know, 43. And it goes up and it goes down a little bit. And there'll be reboots and there'll be Marvel Nows and there'll be the new 52. But it really hasn't changed.
The biggest
over the last few years.
I think that depending on where you're from, the almost sad thing is that 100,000 is mid-tier, maybe upper mid-tier when it comes to webcomics. As far as like the high-tier thing, is like they've got way more than that. I don't know who makes more money though, but
the size of the population that reads comics on a monthly basis is incredibly small. I mean, it's about, I mean, if the top selling issue is 100,000 and all those aren't even being read, I mean, you know, you're still getting, eventually they might get read. It's a teeny tiny part of the population. The teeniest tiny part of the reading population with the loudest, most number of blogs devoted to nitpicking every single, and I include myself in there. It's a very small population. When you look at a book, at the graphic novels that sell the top 10, if you know, the superhero ones don't sell that much. You know, you're talking about books like Drama by Raina Talgemeier, who writes for middle school. I have a middle school daughter. You know, that book sells lots and lots and lots of copies. You know, you're talking about web comics. You're talking about somebody like a Kate Beaton, you know, who isn't really doing superhero comics. You're certain she's parodied them. So the world of superhero comics is quite small. Why superhero comics get so much focus and attention is because the IP that is created in superhero comics gets mined for very, very, very large things. You know, the number of people who saw the Avengers is millions, you know, millions upon millions. The movie made the highest, I think it's finally made the list of the highest, it is the highest grossing movie. And maybe I'm not right, but it's got to be like one or two. Billions of dollars. You know, 1 out of 1,000 of those people are never going to pick up a comic book. They could pick up comic books. They might pick up comic books. You know, I mean, this is an argument that goes back and forth.
The problem is
they're never going to pick up a comic book.
The biggest problem, I would argue. Now, I heard that there's apparently some sort of law where they can't do this. It sounds completely fishy to me. But whenever you see comic book characters in TV shows, cartoons, movies, anything, everything, they never frickin' also advertise that, oh, hey, you can pick up this blah, 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 a comic every month, a blah, blah, blah. You know, they don't do anything like that. So it's like for as what anybody else knows, that's any kids that are watching this, any other people that are just see something, they have no frickin' idea that there's a comic book of it. That's why.
I agree with you. I mean, I think that the distribution system that is used, has been used for comics over the past 20 to 30 years, which is the direct selling, which is, you know, Diamond distributes, you order, you go into the comic shops, and there's only like 2,000 comic shops in like the United States. And that number may even sound be not right, but it's not like there's one. I live in Boston where I can literally drive in about 15 minutes to about 5 different shops.
Oh, yeah. And I'm in Minnesota. It's the same way. I mean,
but you go out to the other parts of the country and you don't have that. It's not, they're not like Stop and Shops or Wegmans or, you know, you know, supermarkets. They're not changed. There's not one on every corner. And I think you're right. You know, I remember when I went to see The Dark Knight Rises, I went to see it the first night, I went to see it with my daughter, and I was like, oh man, I wish I had bought a stack of like, you know, a Nightfall and just stood outside the movie theater going, hey, did you like that? Buy this for $20. Buy this for $20. Because I don't think people realize that you can go in and you can get comics. Now, they do make the connection a little bit in terms of letting people who in these mass media things find out, oh, there's a comic that does that. The one that probably has done it the best this year and has been the biggest surprise has been Smallville. Smallville was a TV show that, when it got canceled, had about 1.7 million viewers a week. When it was a really big hit when it first started, it, like a top 2 million up to 3 million. And it was
1.7 million is still pretty good if it's
It's a TV show, you know, TV show made on a budget of $1.99, if you've ever watched that. But the show was, you know, the story of the early years of Superman. Had some of the characters, Lex Luthor, Lois Lane, and it had a very intense following because the show kind of walked a thin line between giving you sort of the superhero stuff, but also some of that soap opera stuff that we talked about earlier, you know, the romance, the relationships. It was a very popular show. And DC, after the show went off the air, wasn't really going to do anything with it. And Jeff Johns, who had been involved in Smallville and is the creative director of DC, he was kind of like, hey, maybe we should do a comic book continuation, maybe a digital comic book, because digital comics are cheaper to make because you're not paying distribution costs. And they hired the writer of Smallville, who's Brian Q. Miller, who had also written for DC Comics. He had written that Batgirl a volume starring Stephanie Brown that we talked about a little bit earlier in the cast. And I don't think anybody ever thought it was going to be anything except, let's do it. Well, maybe we can make some money off of that. And it's become a very, very strong hit to the point that they went from having it be digital to now they're issuing floppy copies of it. And I'm really convinced that a good deal of the audience for that were people who weren't reading comics before. In fact, when they looked at the people who were downloading it digitally, those people hadn't signed up for digital distribution before. They hadn't been looking to get comics before. So there's a good example of, look, there's this really huge section of people who like comics characters, but they're not reading comics. How can you bring the two together? And I've been of the belief that digital is probably going to be some way to sort of create a bridge between the two, because you don't have to go into a comic shop. You can create out of continuity comics that really don't have to do with the rest of what's going on in the proper comic world. And they're doing that with Green Arrow. You know, there's the Arrow show that's on the CW. They've now got a digital version of that. Mm-hmm. Plus they're running their Green Arrow. They're doing out of continuity Batman stories, which are great for people who went to see The Dark Knight and like, I just don't want to know, you know, just like you were saying, Kelly, I don't know who this Damian character is. I don't know who this is, but I just want to read a story where Batman's really great and they're done in one stories. So I think that there's a little bit more sense that, wow, if I could get 1 out of 1,000 of those people who went to see The Dark Knight, or even 1 out of 100,000, I might do pretty good. And I think you'll see more of that from Marvel. Marvel really hasn't done very much with original digital comics. They've got so many titles in print anyways, but you know, they now have a comic called Avengers Assemble, which is being written by Kelly Sue DeConnick, who's a really terrific comic writer, very fresh voice. And it's one of the few comics that, if you like the movies, The Avengers, you can pick it up and you'll get sort of the same characters, kind of the same tone, kind of the same sort of like, oh, let's joke around. And then there's something scary. I don't know why they didn't do a comic that was based on the Avengers movie. But, you know, I think they're learning. I think they're learning as they go along that maybe they can have a little bit of, a fall off from, you know, the larger audience.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, sometimes I almost feel like the reservation behind doing, like, you know, it's like they're worried that it's like branching off too much. It's kind of like when there was like Street Fighter, the movie, the game, and, you know. It's like Avengers, the comic, the movie, the comic.
They used to do all like specials, like for movies and stuff.
Yep.
Just
they
the
do.
Novelization, I guess, or the comic.
Yeah, like special. Honestly, I do kind of like you know, if you like, because I like the animated universe kind of stuff. Like those are probably the most Batman comics I've read are like the ones based on kind of like the DC animated universe and stuff. Cause I just, you know, it's a storyline that I kind of enjoy the tone they keep in it more than like sort of the, I don't know. It's almost like just the, I don't know, when you have like the main Batman and the writers are always kind of switching out, it's just sort of like a, you know, like a grab bag of like, okay, who's going to be writing it this time? But like the animated universe stuff, like they keep it fairly similar in tone to like the animated series. So, you know, that's kind of like, you're talking with like, movie comic spinoffs and stuff. There was a point I was getting at, but I've I'm too nervous. It's like I don't talk for 20 minutes, and I'm like, oh wait, I'm allowed to talk now.
Yeah, it could be like that.
I think they did a great job with the comics that came out of the Batman the Animated Series, and they looked similar. They had their own sort of universe, and they were fun. They were to me, they were some of the best Batman comics that DC's published over a couple of decades.
And we're gonna have to take another break, so Kelly can't talk again for a while. And we'll be right back.
Your girl is lashed to the railroad track. Twirl my mustache and let my evil laugh. I stroke my cat and then I steeple my hair. But my smoking bat as I reveal my plans. Now this lies feeling now I try to decide. What bad guy line applies to my diatribe? How about no Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Oh man, kneel before Zod or give yourself to the dark side.
From hell's heart, I stab at thee.
But wait until they get a load of me.
How about me?
Challenge the will of doom.
Yeah, I get you my pretty and your little dog too.
Revenge is a dish best served cold.
I did it 20 minutes ago.
Take whatever booty you can find, but remember the feast is mine.
I'm moving up to kidnapping, should be more polite.
Yeah, but dance with the devil in the pale moonlight.
Just when I thought I was out there, pull me back in.
Is foiled again.
Who fights and runs away? Lives to fight another day.
Are you be assimilated?
Now while you hang there and consider your fate,
should I say release the hounds or just say exterminate?
I have something to say. It's better to run out than to fade away.
Did I ever tell you how I got these scars?
I think the word you're looking for is ah.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Impressive, but you are not a Jedi yet.
It puts the lotion on its skin, or else it gets the hose again.
That was Mwahaha by Ookla the Muck, found at the Funny Music Project at thefump.com. All right. So we're now to our last segment of the show. And I did want to get a couple of news, maybe just one news bit in here before we get back to the regular programming. And that is that I did mention this on the 5th anniversary special episode, or didn't I? I mentioned it somewhere. and I have a new thing. It's the webcomic blind date for 2013 that I did mention at least somewhere before. And but I got a new date. This is basically the same thing as last year. People can enter by January 19th. Valentine's Day is coming up, and we're revitalizing the Blind Date project that was headed by Xavier Xerxes of Comics Talk way back when. Basically, artists and basically comic creators, or you maybe not even have to do a comic. If you're a writer or an artist, or could be both, send us an email at webcomicbeacon@gmail.com and by January 19th, and then we'll set up writers and artists on a blind date to create a Valentine's Day comic. There's a lot more information on the site, and I'll certainly link to all of the information. But we had eight people complete four comics last year. We want to beat that. We did have some flakes that didn't show up for the dates last year. And so the 19th date will give us enough time that if there are any people that flake out, that we can find replacements as well. So there is that. I think you can go to webcastbeacon.com/blind date and it'll take you there. Anyway, look for links in the show notes. So back to DC Women Kicking Ass. You had a tournament a few months ago. Basically to vote for the most kick-assiest women, in the DC universe anyway.
I did. I've done it. That was the third year that I've done that tournament, and it's probably the most popular, feature that I do. People look forward to it. What I do is I ask people to vote, you know, for characters. There's a first round where people are able to submit three names of characters, and it's any character in the history of DC Comics. I'm not picky. People have their picks, you know, on they like one Huntress versus, you know, another Huntress. And I narrow it down to 32. And then what I do is we take the number of votes they get, and then we rank them just like you would do. They do March Madness, right? You know, so the person who gets the four people who get the biggest amount of votes, you know, sort of are in, own their own quadrants. And then I go around and we seed the people so that you end up with the very popular people probably going up against the people who didn't get very many mentions. And mm-hmm. then it happens on a daily basis. And then we get down to the quarterfinals and the finals and then down to the big finals. And it's very fun because people get really into it, like seriously into it. And I have friends who are like, have their favorite characters, and they're like, oh, you're killing me. You know, I shouldn't be acting like this. You know, I'm at work. I'm a grown woman. You know, I have a real job, and I'm running around going, go on this side, vote for my character. Go on this side. Because I think people really do get, and it's fun because you also get a lot of the creators because they want, you know, they'll support their characters too. So, you know, Brian Q. Miller, he was supporting the character he wrote, which is Stephanie Brown. Greg Rucka always supports Batwoman as J.H. Williams. And then you'll get people like Dana Delaney, who portrayed Lois Lane on the animated show. You know, she retweeted the fact that, you know, Lois was out there. So I've had lots and lots of creators participate as well. Gail Simone always participates. And it's just a lot of fun. And you do. And it's very hard for me because, of course, I have to be very – you know, I know shenanigans. You know, I have my favorite characters, and my favorite character hasn't even been in the finals for the last 2 years. So I try to you know, just remain objective. And but it's a lot of fun. It's amazing how nutty people will get. You know, it's like, oh, go vote for, I beg you, please go vote for, you know, Black Canary. You have to get it. You have to get her in there. And it's just a lot of fun. This year, I was kind of disappointed because there were people doing like reversing, which is, I don't like what they did to this character, so don't go vote it. You know, and I was like, you know, you're taking the fun out of it. Let's keep it fun and let's keep it. It's energetic. So it is one of my favorite things to do.
Was that the one that, like, the last round, or, like, the last time you ran it, there was, like, a round between, like, Barda and Huntress or something? Because I remember seeing people freaking out about some, like...
Yes.
Yeah, it was, you know, everyone was like, go vote for Barda. Like, she doesn't stand a chance against Huntress, but...
Yeah, just, people you know, get, like, yeah, they're all that. Like, yeah, she deserves this. She's not going to get any votes. Well, you know, I try very hard to you know, to keep the seeding so that they're random. I don't, the only time I'll kind of like move somebody from one to like, I'm like, cause out of randomness, it's like, oh, every back character is in one category. That's not going to work. So let's sort of do it. And I've actually, the first couple of years I worked with somebody who actually did seedings for girls basketball tournaments. So they kind of showed me how you did it. So I've gotten pretty good at it. But yeah, I love how when I reveal the two people who are going up against each other, inevitably I get the same thing. Oh, you're killing me. Oh, this is the worst choice ever. This is the worst. I'm like, it's always the worst choice ever. You know, it's like, oh, I can't believe, because I'm always amazed. Like, I'm always like, oh, this will be an easy match. Cause like, you know, it's this character and I know they're pretty popular, but then it's like a couple of them, I was like really surprised. Like, Black Canary, I think, was in the semifinals this year, and a couple of years she hadn't even made it in to the finals. So there's always sort of like Cinderella stories, you know, people are like, oh, they won't make it into the last round. I'm like, whoa, they really got a lot of votes. And of course it's very heavily weighted towards the Bat family because, you know, DC's entire revenue stream is heavily weighted towards the Bat family. There's always going to be more Bat, and there's new characters that come along. There's when they rebooted the Birds of Prey for the New 52, the writer created a new character called Starling, who I really like. She's a really fun character. She's
new?
Yeah, she's brand new. She was created for the New 52, and she packs six guns, and she's sort of a con woman, and she has like a big tattoo sleeve up and down her arm, and she's got very snippy sayings. And she actually made it pretty far into the tournament for a new character.
Was she the one driving the car in the first issue with
yes,
that guy?
Yes, okay. Yes, that's the one. She drives there. The joke is that she's crashed like 20 cars. She's not a very good driver. She's a good getaway driver, but she's not a good driver because inevitably it smashes. And so she actually got a lot of votes. And I was a little surprised because I didn't think new characters would actually get that level of popularity, but she did okay. I mean, she didn't make it into the final eight, but she made it out of like the first two rounds, I think. And so, you know, you're always surprised to see characters like that, but inevitably it's a Bat character at the end because you know, it's mm-hmm. As I've said many times, DC should just change their logo to Batman going by this.
Do you have you gotten some really obscure heroes? Like, I keep thinking, what about, I don't know, Night Owl or somebody from the Legion of Superheroes?
Yeah, there's always people who will, you know, like, and I'm not a Legion of Superheroes person, so it's like Shrinking Violet, is that one? And
She was pretty badass in the 80s.
Yeah, there's some people who will have, there's a couple of people who every year, God bless them, they come when it comes time to, you know, sort of like say, okay, bring me your three top characters so we can build a list. And it will be, you know, somebody from 1940s or, you know, one of the Legion of Superheroes, or sometimes, you know, it's a character or there are a lot of people who will choose their Supergirl. You know, it's like, I want the Supergirl that was a hybrid of Supergirl in this. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, put it down. I mean, sometimes they'll make it in, but the Legion of Superhero people don't really. And the thing that's most fascinating to me about the tournament is, of the five or six female characters that DC has that they merchandise, in merchandise, it's Wonder Woman, Supergirl, Batgirl, Catwoman, and then the other character is Harley Quinn. And Harley Quinn never makes it into the tournament. She's hugely popular. And I mean, obviously she's in a lot. She's in comics. She's in their games. I mean, she was a huge part of Arkham City. She was in the TV show. She was created for the TV show.
Yes, she was.
But for some reason, every year, I'll see a couple of people will write down Harley Quinn, but she doesn't. Poison Ivy's made it into the tournament each and every year. But for some reason, Harley Quinn just does not make it. And I find that fascinating because I would think, oh, yeah, sure, she should be in there.
I think, do you think, okay, just how about this in general? Do you think that the villains don't get in as often.
No, because they do.
As often as the heroes.
I think that's fair to say, but you know, you also have character. I guess you're right. But I don't know. Is Catwoman a villain? I can never quite be sure.
She's one of those
she's like
sort of
hero kind of.
In
yeah,
between.
She's an anti-hero, I guess. But isn't Harley kind she's of like an anti-hero as well?
Yeah, she's like when Harley's with Ivy and they're kind of staying out of Batman's hair. It seems kind of like they get the same like Catwoman. I mean, I guess they're not the same as Catwoman and Batman.
The bat trope tends to be in the ambiguous category. The scale isn't as obvious as good or evil. It's wavering being in the middle, if it were a slider, essentially. That's what I've been told.
Well, I think it's an interesting thing, you know. There's always – I've had somebody write an essay on my blog about, you know, women and being villains, and that there really aren't that many hardcore female villains. I mean, the Joker's just bad. I mean, the Joker's never an anti-hero. I mean, you know, maybe you can go back when he had his own comic and, you know, you might say, oh, he was kind of just a goofy guy. But, you know, there are just real – Vandal Savage is never going to be, you know, sort of a character where you go, oh, yeah, that Vandal Savage, he's not so bad after all. But Lex Luthor, maybe. I mean, I think you can sort of make the case that sometimes they try to – but inevitably he turns out to be a scumbag at the end.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. But necessarily scumbag doesn't equate to evil. Now, this brings me up to another point that I want to get – I totally freaking remember and now – I forgot and now remember kind of what I wanted to have you on the show to begin with.
There you go.
I wanted to talk – we don't really have that much time now, but I wanted to ask the question. We can at least have the question, but I kind of wanted a whole episode of discussion on this. But the question is – in are women in particularly like Marvel or DC universes where you have like the over like the superhero and the supervillain sort of stuff, are women more redeemable than their male counterparts as far as villains go? It seems to me that more women tend to either go from evil to good than the male ones are, or there's a lot more females that are sort of like in that ambiguous category in the middle.
They almost seem like more reserved to make like just really horrible women. Like it sort of seems like, you know, they don't let them be like too bad. Like, I don't know.
I think that there is a tendency to not want to make for women not to be 100% bad. I mean, you don't have a female Joker. And you don't have, you know, I'm trying to think of a big, really bad, unredeemable villain. Somebody who's done. There's been some characters that have somewhat been like that. I mean, you could say that Cheetah, who is Wonder Woman's thing, she's traditionally been bad. But even that, they kind of made her towards the end before the new 52 launch. She was like kind of coming like she was hanging out with Snapper Carr, you know, he used to be in the Justice League and, you know, being all cuddly and cute with him. And they made Giganta into kind of an anti-heroine. I think there's just this idea that a woman kind of has to be soft for her to be acceptable to
I don't think that's it at all. I think it's because we don't want them to be evil. I think it's as simple as that. It's like, oh, we like her so much. Here's the thing. Now, this is really bad, and I'm going to admit that this is really bad. But a lot of people think that ugly people should be evil and the good-looking people should be good. Oh, and it's always such a shame that because she's so beautiful, why does she have to be evil sort of thing? I think it's as simple as that, that male sort of perspective as in, well, if she wasn't evil, she'd be like perfect. You know, I think it's very, very, I think it's as clear and as shallow as that, honestly.
Oh, I think it has a lot to do, Shell. I mean, you don't see ugly villainesses in comics. I mean, you don't see women who aren't, you don't see that many women that don't adhere to the, you know, the traditional female, you know, body. I mean, one of the few characters that was sort of threw all the tropes aside was Amanda Waller, who was the head of the Suicide Squad. I mean, here was a woman who was African-American. You don't see that many women like that. She was certainly not skinny. I mean, she was a good-sized woman. And she also had a very flexible moral code. I mean, she killed people. She killed people on page. Shot a person in her bedroom while sitting there in her negligee and her slippers. And she ran black ops, and she threatened people, and she blackmailed people. And, you know, for 20 years, she was like a really great character. Not such a great character. She's one of the few characters that emerged from comics to go into multimedia. I mean, she appeared in Smallville. She appeared in the Green Lantern movie. She created an entire trope, which is the overweight or heavy black female who doesn't take shit from anybody. I mean, until the new 52, Eparatha Epperson, but from all of these women who appeared in cop shows after that, I think that you can blame them in. And look what happened to her. They rebooted the new 52. What did they do?
They made her super skinny.
Super skinny, big boobs, lipstick, everything.
Yeah, that's not why they called her the Wall.
No.
Because of her last name. Yeah. The Wall.
You're right. So I do think you're right. I think it's the idea that if there's this belief that a woman can, you know, somehow be, you know, sort of redeemable. And I've fallen into that trope myself because there's a character that I kind of really like, which is Cheshire, who I don't know if she's been seen in the new 52. She might have been, but for years, Cheshire was the character who Roy Harper. She was Roy Harper's baby mama. She became the a character who had Roy Harper's baby, Leanne Harper. And she blew up an entire country with a nuclear bomb. She tried to poison everybody. She stole. She was terrible. I mean, she's just a terrible, evil female character. But she was a mother. And they would show her occasionally in scenes with her child. And, oh, I love you, I love you, I love you. And then I would get in discussions with people. Well, is she entirely evil, or does she have this, you know, is she just an evil person, but she still loves her kid? And is that a way for you to sort of make you think that she isn't evil, or does she use it? And it was a very interesting discussion because I don't think that people would have that about a male character. And I always found it interesting because she was horrible. I mean, she blew up an entire country with a nuclear bomb. I mean, really,
it's said that people are the heroes of their own stories. They're not evil. They just think, well, at least if you write them good, they're not being evil. They're doing what they think is right, or this is like the lesser of two evils, and they totally justify things, at least in their own mind.
Great.
There's that one, and then there's the just criminally insane where maybe they're just not a hero, not a hero of their own story. They're just freaking insane, like say the Joker. And then there's the idea that there is just pure evil, and of course this is still comics, but in reality people say, you know, that there is no such thing as a true evil. And I don't know, I mean, you can argue that point up and down, I suppose.
I don't know. I mean, I think it's
no one wakes up to twiddle their mustache in the morning, you know.
Actually, I do. I grew my mustache out, and now it is twirling length.
Well, I think you're right. You know, going back to what Kelly had mentioned, Secret Six, and again, I think that was one of the interesting things about that story is all those people were pretty bad. I mean, they killed, they blackmailed, they did really, really awful things, but they really thought that all the things that they did, you know, were okay because, you know, that's what they did. I mean, they knew they did bad things, but they became sort of heroic in their own way because they went off and did things that, you know, other people wouldn't do. So I think you're right. I think, the Joker hasn't been around for years because people think he's just bad. I mean, he has a huge fan base of people who think he's awesome. You know, they just think he's like the greatest character ever because he's like crazy and maniacal and manipulative. And, you know,
someone has suggested that the Joker is the only person in the DC universe that actually does remember after each reboot, which is why he's crazy.
That probably very, very well. I think that's an interesting theory. I thought it was Vandal Savage. It would be Vandal Savage because, you know, he's an internal and he goes on forever. But that could be it. But the Joker is, I mean, the Joker is just one of those characters that people are really drawn to. And he's not a particular favorite of mine. I'll be honest with you. I'm like, I'm kind of done with the Joker. But, you know, I have a nephew who's you know, he's I guess he's finally out of his teens or something. He just thinks the Joker's great. I mean, he's read like Azzarello's Joker book a couple of times. I mean, he loved the Dark Knight, you know, because of Heath Ledger. Killing Joke is one of the greatest books ever written. You can imagine the discussions I've had about that. But you know, he really thinks he's a really great character, and he is. He is a great character, and the idea that, you know, so many people invest in him, and they so many writers are drawn to him. I mean, like, look at, I mean, Grant Morrison made him the centerpiece of his entire Batman arc. Scott Snyder has made him the centerpiece of his second major arc that he's writing as the character. If you go back and you look at all of the people who've written Batman at one time or another, they've probably written a Joker story. So, and he's just like Aki. And evil. I don't like him. More like a Riddler person.
Yeah. I always going back on that thought, I always kind of wanted, like, what if there was, like, just a normal guy that we'd never heard about who has a superpower, but he's not, like, a superhero or anything. Just, like, one of those regular guys you see on the street. And they remember every single continuity reboot, but they're just like a guy. They have like a regular day job, and it's like they really can't tell anybody because it's like, oh, they're crazy or something like that. Who would believe them, you know? Because he knows everything, but he can't do anything with it, you know?
maybe Pariah from the original Crisis?
No, I was just thinking
or
just
Psycho Pirate?
A regular guy.
Psycho Pirate, or it could be Superboy Prime. Right.
It's like one of those guys in Watchmen who, like, you know, reading magazines at the newsstand, and they just remember like all the reboots.
That would be interesting. Well, I'm sure, you know, and you know, as we're saying that, probably Grant Morrison is probably writing something like that
maybe.
For his multiple.
Well, there's, I mean, for a little, I mean, if you look at it, in the new DC 52, the new 52, there are some characters that do know, and that would be the Phantom Stranger, Pandora, and that other, the Question.
Yeah, I guess it would be the Question too. I think that's all going to come out in the Trinity War thing that they've got coming up this summer. It, you know, here's my take on the continuity thing. And I wasn't a really big fan of what they did to a lot of characters. But as I've said a couple of times, I would have felt a lot better if they had done this. They had just said, look, We're creating a new universe. Doesn't mean this old universe doesn't exist anymore. It does. It's up on this planet. And you know what? Maybe we're going to write comics about it every so often, and it still exists in all the trades. But all those characters are still there, and you know, Barbara Gordon is still Oracle, and Stephanie Brown is still Batgirl.
Kind of like Marvel did with like the Ultimate Universe, like
exactly.
Yeah, that's
just like
that's
here's
what they
a new
done.
Like semi reboot.
Like here's Amazing Batman or Ultimate Batman or Super Fantastic Batman, you know, whatever the fuck Marvel does.
Exactly, and you know, I think if they had done that, I think, and they said, and you know what, maybe we'll go visit them. They're all in trades. But they're all still there. We're not changing them. We're not doing anything. This is our new universe. It is called the New 52.
Well,
and you're going to see characters that look like the ones that still exist, but they're different. I think a lot of people still would have taken, you know, and complained about it. But I probably would have been like, yeah. I get it. It's fine. It's okay. What happened was is that they kind of like – did like a Chinese buffet of, well, we're going to take a little bit of this from Batman, and we're going to take a little of this from Superman, and we're going to take a little bit of that, and we're going to take a little bit of that, and we're going to kind of make it this and kind of make it that, and then, you know, actually we're going to change it midway because we don't think it's there. And they ended up with something that really was kind of kludgy, and people don't like kludgy. If there's one thing comic people like, is they like clarity. They don't collect all those board and bag those comics for 25 years just so they can have somebody come along and say, no.
Well,
Tim Drake was never a Robin. No, he wasn't. He was a Red Robin. And we're going to and it's like, no, he was. I've got every issue Chuck Dixon ever written of that. Uh-huh. No, anyways, I think it just could have been handled a little bit better. And I think people would have been happy.
I feel like that's always the frustrating thing with, because, you know, it's so many people playing in the same sandbox. And, you know, you saw the same thing come up when they did, like, Joe Quesada kind of took over Spider-Man, and he was like, all right, no more marriage. I want the Spider-Man that I grew up reading and stuff like that. And it was just kind of like, oh, like, you know, you can have one writer that you're like, you know, that writer made the definitive version of that character for you. And then the next guy can come in and, like, wave his hand and be like, nope, 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 didn't happen. And it like, I've said it before, but I almost wish that, like, they were doing sort of like, you know, a self-contained kind of like installments to the mythos, and, you know, like, you didn't have to have, like, every person had to find some way to incorporate, like, every other person's continuity into their comic. And
right. Mm. Yeah. Right. Right. It is. And it's, you know, it's interesting. We had a discussion on our podcast last year with Kelly Sudokonic, who's wrote for DC. She wrote some of the last issues of Supergirl before the reboot, and now she's writing Captain Marvel and Avengers Assemble for Marvel. And we were talking about continuity now, and I'm a continuity junkie. Why? Because I'm a soap opera junkie. I mean, soap opera junkies and continuity, it's all the same thing. And she was saying an interesting thing, which is she said that she thought there should be no continuity, that Batman, you would have a year of Batman, and then at the end of that story arc, everything would reset again, and you would tell a whole new story.
No, I disagree.
That's kind of what I'm talking about. Like,
yeah, and I
disagree. I absolutely disagree, because what makes a sitcom more boring than going back to the status quo at the end of each episode? That is so boring. And it's like the continuity, the past, the what you grew up with. And the problem is, I'm going to tell you this, the problem is the numbering system. You got this huge numbering system, and nobody knows where to jump in at, because they don't sub-label the story arcs. You know where to get in, or if you just want to read the story. You get into people's minds with a number. It's like, for me, if like when I started buying New 52 comics, I started buying until I stopped liking it, then I stopped getting it, which means I'm not getting back up on it, because then I would have numbers missing in between. It's a big mental thing
because you're new to comics.
It doesn't matter. I'm not going to keep buying stuff that I'm not liking. And if something looks interesting, I'm hesitant to buy it because of the numbering system, because then I'll have a huge gap. You know,
I understand why continuity, like, has its place and how you can do, like, these big events and stuff with it. But, like, a lot of the time it's like, I'll buy, like, one arc that's, like, a kind of open and shut, you know, like, self-contained piece. And then it's like you're talking, like, there'll be, you know, another couple of years of continuity in between that's totally, like, unrelated and has a totally different tone and does things that I don't like with the characters. And then there'll be, like, another arc of something that I do enjoy, but it's like you've missed out all the stuff, you know, like, the person who takes up that next arc, like, the first couple, you know, they have to waste a bunch of time just sort of, like, explaining away and getting rid of, like, all, you know, like, erasing what they didn't like from the last bit, so that, like, they can tell the story that they wanted to tell. And it's just, you know, it's kind of like, I'd rather it was just, like, its own pocket book of, like, all right, this is, like, this self-contained arc that's telling the story, like, this person wants to tell. And I don't know, it's almost like that Elseworlds kind of stuff, like, you know, they can, you know, it doesn't need to be, like, the one definitive Batman. Like, if they want to make Bruce Wayne, like, you know, like, a little more of a, like, kind of asshole, it's like when they did the Ultimate Marvel, and Professor Xavier in that, like, was not kind of a warm, fatherly, you know, like, mentor character. He was kind of an asshole. And it's like, if they were doing more, like, you know, like, here is a self-contained Colossus story that you can buy it and you can read it, and that's, like, the whole, like, that is the one Colossus, then, you know, if you wanted to make kind of an asshole Professor Xavier, you would be able to do that and not have to worry about, like, what universe you were writing in and who was writing him before and who's going to take him afterwards and stuff.
Yeah, that we should totally have more, like, what-if comics back, you know? Just have some freaking fun. But with that in mind, this is the end of this particular episode of the Webcomic Beacon. And if you don't like it, you can go make your own headcanon of what this episode would have turned out to be. And also to say that
ultimate
this...
Ultimate Webcomic Beacon.
Ultimate Webcomic Beacon.
Webcomic Beacon.
Else Beacon.
Else Beacon. This is...
The new 52 Beacon.
This is there's been 255 episodes of the Webcomic Beacon. I can tell you there's not a whole lot of continuity in there. So you can actually go to, if you are kind of new to the Webcomic Beacon podcast, you can go to webcastbeacon.com/new if you're a new listener, and there is a selection of Webcomic Beacon episodes, first issue episodes, and Web Fiction World episodes. Some of the ones that I think are really good. So especially we had an interview with Mark Wade for episode 253. That was really cool to hear a professional print comic book writer getting into webcomics. And from my standpoint, he totally freaking gets it, and it's awesome.
He's great. He's a terrific guy.
And so that is it. I'm running out of recording space. Actually, so, Sue, I want to thank you for coming on to the show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yes, once again, you can go find Sue's work at dcwomenkickingass.tumblr.com. You can also check her out on a podcast. She's on the Three Chicks podcast at comicbookresources.com. I'm not sure what the actual quick URL for that is, but... just search for Three Chicks Podcast on Comic Book Resources, and you should get a list of episodes of that. Is there anything else we need to plug for you?
You can always pick up the book Three Chicks Dig Comics, which was published last year. It's a series of essays by a variety of people and women, all talking about comics. I think Gail Simone is in there. I believe Jen Van Meter is in there. And I'm in there, too, talking about soap operas and comics. So you can pick that up on Amazon.
There we go. Email me the link if you remember.
And okay.
And let's see here. Oh, yeah, this is totally the end of the show. But remember that we do have that webcomic Blind Date 2013 heading up. If you're interested, email webcomicbeacon@gmail.com by January 19th. There'll be a link to more information on the website at webcastbeacon.com. I've been Fess of ArjaComic.com, updating soon.
I'm Kelly of the punchline is muchismo.com.
And this is Mark of AutumnLake.com.
I just don't hear the name Ronaldo anymore.
I don't. It's a shame.